on WGN. Mike Miller joins us again from DePaul University, the economist over there. Hi, Mike. Thanks for joining us. How are you today?
Oh, I'm doing really well, John.
You have anything to say about what I just said? I wonder if I was talking about the gas prices, and that's a sign that it's backfiring. Tricked any nerves there? What did you hear in that?
No, I guess we would use the word propaganda. You know, oil, as you know, is a commodity that is traded worldwide, and there's a worldwide price, and those sanctions are not the major cause of the price being high. It's just a supply and demand issue.
Yeah, that's not why we called you today, but just on that notion, I think there are some people who are critical of President Biden for either not opening up the last arm of the pipeline or freeing up the reserves sooner or being a champion of green energy and not hydrocarbons. Can the president move the price much?
No, I don't believe that he can. I'm one who believes that the strategic petroleum is there for a time of a true crisis, not one to be touched. And certainly the pipeline would have made it a safer way to move the oil from Canada to the United States, but it wasn't going to be open at the moment. It would affect the long-term price of crude oil, but it would and the price of gasoline, but it wouldn't affect the price of gasoline today. So I'm not sure how much blame, although I think that we would see that the contracts going forward would be lower
right.
price of oil if we would drill more and so forth.
The president is frustrated that the strong economic indicators he could point to are being met with, you said, such negativity by the public. What's going on there, Michael?
Yeah, I try to be an economist first and then my conservative self second. And if you look at the situation, the labor market is probably second to none, like almost to the point that it was right before the onset of the pandemic. We had the greatest labor market probably in 50 years, and I think we're very close to that again. So the labor market is wonderful. The housing market's doing fine. We gross domestic product, the overall measure of how much we're producing, adjusted for inflation, and we're growing at or above potential. So any president would love to have these particular figures. And however, when you ask Americans, how are we doing? Large numbers of them say we're not doing well at all. Now, one thing is that this is not unusual. There have been mismatches between people's perception of the economy and the actual economy. But the one thing that is weighing on Americans right now is inflation, and that number is quite bad. And on top of it, that inflation is being driven partly by these changes in the price of crude oil. And there's some interesting, it's just correlations. There's no guarantee that it's what you would call a causation. But we have found that the people's perception of how well they are doing and how well the economy is doing is tied to the price of gasoline. Huh. And when gas prices are high, people are upset. And it's just maybe it's almost a silly thing to think about. I did a quick Google search and looked up some things in the government data. What percent of an average household's budget is spent on gasoline? And it's less than 5%. And to worry about that 5% as though that's the driving factor in your life, it just doesn't seem rational, but it is what people emotionally respond to.
Yeah. You know, my friend Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute made an interesting point in our podcast, The Mincing Rascals, the other day. He said that's the one thing that people see when they drive up and down the street every day. You don't see the price of apples. You don't see even what the interest rates are. You don't see anything positive about the economy. All you see on signs everywhere at gas stations is gas going up, gas going up. It's our everyday intersection with the economy. So if the number is bad, you can begin to understand where people get that view. We want to pause here, Michael. Stay right there. I also
sure.
wanted to ask you what you were discovering about what happened with stimulus dollars. And we'll talk more about the mm-hmm. economy and you with Michael Miller from DePaul. Mike Miller is an economist over at DePaul University. By the way, we were just talking about gas prices, Michael, and I wanted to mention this to you. We were talking about Willie Wilson, the entrepreneur in Chicago who ran for mayor last time, didn't win, but was giving out gas cards, actually was giving $50 worth of gas this week to people at, what was it, 10 stations, and it was $200,000 worth of gas. He is now, this is his post today. Wilson announces $1 million worth of free gas as Cook County residents experience the highest fuel prices in 14 years. 50 participating gas stations agree to lower prices to serve more families and invites the press, elected officials, and clergy to pump gas. The idea that the cost of gas is high means we're going through an economic crisis. God bless Willie Wilson, but it gets reinforced by stunts like this, doesn't it?
Oh, that's something. I admire that man. I mean, he's self-made millionaire, from what I understand.
Yeah.
And he, I admire him. I just think that's, and it's his money. He can give it to whomever he wants for whatever reason he wants. And I think this is a perfectly sound thing, you know, especially if the money goes to people in neighborhoods that have, you know, that have lower income, because gasoline prices affect lower income people more who have to drive than people like you and me. And if Willie's helping them out, I think that's wonderful.
There were questions earlier in the pandemic about how the stimulus dollars were being used, how the relief checks to people were being used. You've looked into that. What are you thinking about that?
Well, I always want to have, before I say that something did happen, I'd like to see some research on it. And I had heard anecdotes during the pandemic, both through members of my own family and through friends, that some people who were receiving these checks, especially people who were still working at the time, that they were using it not only to meet their budgetary needs, but they also kind of thought of it as some play money. And they were using it to buy things like crypto and to buy into the stock market. And so one thing economists always do is we wait to see what does the research show. And a couple of economists decided to look into that matter, and they were able to access data that showed them that households that did receive some of the stimulus checks did put money towards the stock market. And we did see that right after, within days of the stimulus checks going out, that retail-friendly stocks, stocks that people could afford, you know, not stocks that cost $2,000 a piece, but retail-friendly stocks jumped in price between 5 and 7%. And so people were taking some of the money, not all of it, and putting it into investments. And what's pretty cool about it is they did actually, if they sold not long after that, they did make money. And so people were using it. I guess, like I say, I call it play money. Sometimes when you have transitory money that you know you're not going to receive again, and it's almost like it's a gift, you do sometimes things like investing or things that you would not normally do. So we now have some strong evidence based upon budgetary credit card action and so forth that people were doing exactly this. They were investing.
What do you think of that?
Well,
do you think that was a misuse? You know what I'm after. Was that a misuse of the money?
I think in general, it is a sign that that idea that you and I have talked over and over about, which is targeted fiscal policy, that these are cases where money was given to those who really didn't quite need it. And yes, I think I don't want to say waste, because, you know, when there could be other expenses, maybe they only used 10% of the money and the other 90% went to very important things. Who knows? Food, medicine, whatever. But yes, there clearly was some excess money given to people who did not need it.
Yeah.
And while that will have a positive effect upon the economy overall, it's not an efficient use of government funds.
As a student of Professor Michael Miller, on the radio anyway, I wonder if that's not a correlation and not a causation. That is, when that much money went into the market, people were shopping, and therefore the value of those stocks naturally went up, not because people were buying stocks, but because business was good.
You know, it could be a combination, but the fact that they would see it is, you know, in economics, it's almost impossible to prove what we would call causation the way you do in science, because we cannot have we can't have restricted experiments where we can control things the way you can in science. So the best economists can do is they look for correlation that is overwhelming. And there is this very wonky thing called Granger causality, which is statisticians use to try to prove it. So you are correct. that this would be only a correlation, and they are inferring that the behavior was tied to it, mainly because of exactly when it occurred, how it occurred, and based upon other data that they had regarding the household budgets.
It's nice to talk to you, Michael. I've got other questions about other things, but I'm really glad you went back and touched on this and your thoughts about Willie Wilson and gas prices and all of that. Thanks for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Again, take care, John.
You do want to sign up for his classes now, don't you? If you go out to the campus of Navy Pier, there is something called the Sable Hotel, and Laurent Boidron is the general manager, and it is the one-year anniversary. Laurent, you're on WGN Radio. Comment ça va?
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm doing well. 1 year, right?
1 year today, so, you know, that's pretty exciting. We are actually having a great package for guests this weekend, so we are, you know, that's the time to visit Chicago. If you want a little staycation this weekend, it's never too late, right? So we are offering a rate of $189, and there's a lot of add-on. We have a sparkling cava wine upon arrival. We have chocolates. We have late checkout and a breakfast credit at our restaurant, Iberian-inspired, called Lyrica.
Wow. Okay, let me go over that. Sparkling wine, chocolates, late checkout, a breakfast package, and you're staying in a nice room on Navy Pier looking out to the lake or the city, $189?
That's right. Yeah, $189. So, and you've been to the hotel, so you know that the rooms are outstanding. You know, there's an amazing view of the lake and the skyline, which is nice. Very well-appointed rooms from Jackie Koo, our architect and designer. So, and the pier is pretty dynamic. You know, it's all basically open and very high energy on the pier right now. So we hope to see more people.
Yeah. Your first year was the second year of the pandemic. How was that?
Well, you know, we were supposed to open November 2020, and we pushed to March. And when we actually opened, the pier was still closed at the time, and we created those packages. And one is called We've Got Space, which is the same today, because we, at the time, you know, it was nobody on the pier except the hotel and the restaurant. So some guests were able to experience, you know, the pier in a different way. And it was nice because it was very quiet and you could walk on the pier and experience, you know, the different scenery of the lake and the colors and everything. So today we are offering the same, but with some add-on for our anniversary year, which is, you know, a year later. So I have to say it has been, you know, a challenging year, but we have been coming out of the very strong, you know. Our weekends are very popular, you know, in this hotel. So we do encourage people to book in advance, obviously, to sablehotel.com.
Laurent, how long are you going to have that price, that special? Is it just for a couple of days? When do I have to stay for the $189 price?
That's a good question. So today, actually tonight, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, so you can get that price if you go to sablehotel.com and book online. And we would love to have you with us, you know, all your listeners, to experience the first year anniversary of the hotel. It's a beautiful hotel, very different than any traditional hotel in Chicago. You're on the pier, you have all those activities. Not to forget the rooftop bar called Offshore, which is also part of the hotel. So a lot of things to do and to experience on the pier.
You guys, that rooftop bar is amazing. And if you were there, say, Sunday night, when maybe the weather will be its best this weekend or any other night, you will not regret it. $189 for the wine, the chocolate, the late checkout, the breakfast package. Looking back on or out to the city, I just think that's a very good offer. But it's for this weekend, so change your plans, whatever you're thinking about doing, and head out there. And you're right, you're probably excited to see, while it was maybe tranquil for people to enjoy the views in the hotel, you're probably anxious for the Children's Museum and the theater and everything else to open up as well.
Yeah, and we're actually partnering with them, both of them, so through the winter with the Chicago Children's Museum, which has been open, and the theater as well, which I think reopened first quarter, so April. So there will be a partnership with them as well for Lyrica, the restaurant. So pre-dinner, pre-theater dinner will be available as well. So, so really it's a great experience. You know, you stay with us, you can entertain, you know, go to the theater, go to the children's museum, experience offshore, go to the restaurant. You know, there's a lot of things to do, and you're on your own bubbles at the pier, as you know. You park your car or you take Uber, you know, and you stay with us, and it's fantastic. And you have a beautiful, amazing view to the lake, so it's to be experienced.
The hotel is called Sable at Navy Pier, sablehotel.com, sablehotel.com. Well, that's good, right? Luck and good on you, sir. Congratulations, Laurent. We'll see you out there sometime soon.
Absolutely. Thank you, John, very much. Thank you.
Laurent Boidron is the general manager of Sable at Navy Pier. 1242 on WGN. More business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Chicago-based Boeing may be about to land a big order from Delta Airlines for up to 100 737 MAX 10 jets. This would be the first major order from Boeing for Delta in nearly a decade. Delta is the only major U.S. carrier without a 737 MAX on order. It's Boeing's best-selling single-aisle airplane. If the deal is reached, an announcement could come as soon as next month. So far, the price is undisclosed. Distress in the downtown Chicago office space has led to the repossessions of two large loop buildings. Cranes reports one of those buildings is at 175 West Jackson and the other is at 135 South LaSalle. Properties had loans of $280 million and $100 million, respectively. According to the report, the repossessions highlight the financial difficulties inflicted on the downtown office market because of the pandemic and remote work. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Steve Alexander has the business of food.
You know, I love how your 2 years as president of the French Club paid off in that conversation with the
It went right by him. I dropped a little French on him, and he didn't respond, ça va bien. So what's the point, you know?
I know. Speaking of high school, I had no idea what I wanted to do with the rest of my life when I was in high school. Did you? That's when we were, what, 16 years old? Well, I had no idea. Maybe you didn't either, but Jordan Gaines sure did.
I went to Homewood Flossmoor High School, and I was just making cakes in my culinary arts class, and I was really, really good at it. I came home, and I told my mom, I want to open a bakery.
And she did, and she got really good at it.
When I really finally realized that it was a business, when I was turning down, you know, going out with friends and doing things that normal teenagers were doing because, you know, I have commitments and I have contracts with people. And I got asked to make a cake for Chaka Khan when I was 19 years old. And I'm like, okay, now this is a business.
A few other Chicago celebs and many more non-celebrities became big fans of her Jordy cakes.
I can make a cake look like anything you could think of, like making edible art.
And then she really got her stride with cake in a jar.
And that's like layers of cake and frosting in a mason jar.
And Jordy jars, as her product is known, were a big hit.
I've been in O'Hare, I've been in the Hyatt Regency, a lot of different locations in Chicago. We ship nationwide.
12 years in business, and then the pandemic hit. Customers went away, and on top of that struggle, she and her husband were raising a family.
I have a 7-year-old, a 1-year-old, and a 2-year-old.
And all of a sudden, they were locked down, homeschooling, and
each of us have gotten COVID at least one time.
So, trying to pivot again, Jordan has begun converting pop machines into cake-in-a-jar vending machines.
I'm in talks with different areas to put more vending machines. You know, I want to talk to the water tower and go back to O'Hare and give them another deal with these vending machines. But how do I pick up the pieces and grow my business if I'm playing catch up?
So now, rather than give up and join the hundreds of thousands of other businesses that closed for good, Jordan is asking her fans to help her get caught up. You can buy online at jordyjars.com. I've got my eyes on a red velvet Oreo brownie. And she has started a GoFundMe. Just search Jordy Cakes and you'll find her story. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Dennis Rodkin joins us on the Wintrust Business Lunch, talking about real estate once again. Hi, Dennis. How are you?
John, I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. The residential real estate reporter at Cranes. You wrote recently about one of the more pricey homes on the North Shore. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the priciest home on the North Shore. Coming on the market next week is a property on the lakefront in Winnetka asking $16 million, highest price, highest asking price on the North Shore, second highest if you include Chicago, because there's a mansion in the Gold Coast asking 18 and a half. This property in Winnetka has been in the same hands since 1970. It was owned by the now deceased James Challenger, who was one of the men who sort of pioneered outplacement of executives. He died in 2019. His family is now selling it. It's quite a house. It's on about 1.8 acres. It's got 150 feet of Lake Michigan beach. Don't know a lot about the house. It was built in around 1902. Some of the history of it is gone, but $16 million is quite a bit of money.
5,000 square feet. I'm reading your piece. It's got a greenhouse and a coach house.
And what's interesting is, so again, it's been in this family since 1970. Challenger's wife died before he did. He's gone. His daughter is a real estate agent representing it for herself and her brothers. And there they sound perfectly okay with the house being torn down. They all grew up there. They've had it for half a century. But she said, we sort of have to be realistic because either way you go, she said, it's a project. If you want to keep the house, it needs extensive restoration.
Really?
If you want to take, even though they kept it up, it's been 50 years. It has a kitchen you would not expect in a house like this, relatively modest 1970 size kitchen in this big lakefront mansion. And there are other things that need updating. So the family sounds fine with it being torn down, which is another kind of a project. Take it down and design a new house, which is what's going on with a lot of those lakefront properties on the North Shore.
Or maybe you like Harvest Gold linoleum and you don't want to change a thing, but
exactly.
I'm amazed. I guess that just says something about that. It's the real estate you're buying, but it's pretty amazing to me that big old house was given that much equity in it. I mean, they could have kept it up just if they had taken out they could have called David Hochberg and borrowed against the house and done whatever they wanted over the years.
You could also rehab it to put it on the market. But I think, you know, she's an agent in Winnetka. She knows what the pressures are up there. And really, a lot of people want to build their own new house, bigger, often more contemporary than what's on the lakefront now. And I think, you know, she's being realistic. Somebody might come in and want to rehab it.
Yeah.
But somebody else might come in and want to build there. You know, there's another one. This is 1.8 acres. Somebody bought, this is all one piece, somebody bought three different parcels, put them together at 3.3 acres, and is building a big house. And this is sort of what's going on with a lot of those lakefront properties, because, of course, lakefront property is a very limited commodity.
Would you extrapolate from all of this? Does this say anything about the economy or Chicago or real estate, or is it just the one-offs from some rich people here?
Well, the thing is, there are a lot of properties priced, a lot of properties that remain on the market for a while. That $18.5 million house, it's been around for a while. It's been on the market since 2020. We have seen some very high-end sales. We saw the Trump penthouse sell for $20 million just a couple of weeks ago. But each one of these has really, you know, has only one buyer. Land on the lake in Winnetka is so desirable. I wouldn't bet anybody on how fast this will sell, but I'm guessing that it sells pretty quickly.
I got a couple minutes left. Talk to me about the Humboldt Park home and what you said about that.
Alderman Maldonado's house. It came on the market earlier this week. It's nearly $2.4 million. He's asking just under $2.4 million for a six-bedroom house a block from the trail that is known as either the 606 or the Bloomingdale Trail, the trail that everybody knows. And I just think it's sort of interesting. He has been one of the prime movers in trying to stop or slow gentrification in Humboldt Park, trying to stop or slow construction of houses exactly like this. Big multi-lot houses, $2.5 million. He told me a couple of years ago that it was important to him to preserve housing for, as he said, people who look like me. He's Latino. And I don't think it's appropriate to say that it's hypocritical to put a house on the market at 2.4 when you've said things like that. But I do think it's noteworthy that you have been a leader of anti-gentrification efforts that push against exactly this sort of house being built in Humboldt Park.
Well, when was the house built? I mean, if he owns a home that was already in existence, is he guilty of that?
He built it in 2009, so he built it about 6 years before the trail opened. And I don't think anybody's guilty when they build a big house. I just think it's worthy of note that these are the kinds of houses he's pushing against. But yeah, he built it well before the 606 was known for several years before it was built. He may have known it was coming, but he did build it before that trail opened and became sort of a what a lot of people call a gentrification channel. Already there were big houses toward the east end, and there was pressure on to build toward the west end. And that's what he and other aldermen have worked to stop. So has the mayor and the city's Department of Housing. So once again, I don't want to say that it's hypocritical. I do think it's noteworthy.
Well put. I'm out of time. You also, by the way, wrote an interesting piece about the racial bias in home appraisals. And I'll just leave it at that for now. You can click on ChicagoBusiness.com and read more of Dennis Rodkin's writing and reporting there. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for the news.
Thank you, John.